what we just did there is not just a little pious drill before we get into doing this. It's not just a way of acknowledging God before we get into our study. It's actually a device, a learning device, a way of working with material, a way of thinking, that I hope you'll use, because I think you need it to get all you can out of this book and to rise both inwardly and outwardly to the incredible challenge and the incredible opportunity that this book throws you. I'm told that in the ancient letters, in Chinese calligraphy, the word for crisis is combined out of two figures, one which means danger and one which means opportunity. And I think that as you approach this book, you'll find that both of those things are there right in your face. And to be able to work with this in a way that you don't split the symbol and you have the danger team and the opportunity team, that would be to waste the opportunity here. But to learn to hold the things together. And in order to do that, you need to learn to think in a new way. This book is based on paradox, and it works in paradox. It's as in your face as the parables of Jesus. And it kind of requires you to think in the same sort of way. So this whole process of learning how to, before you just react and say, I agree or I don't agree, which is the kind of typical way we're taught to work our way with things in most of our Western culture, what you need to do is, first of all, be still and know that I am God, and practice that art of letting go of the thought. Your opinions on it, the thought, the practicing. It's like take a deep breath before you respond to anything. That's a good corporate management skill. But I'm going to show you in just a little while why that is so actually immediately bound up in getting at what he's saying here. Because in order to hear this book in a new way, you have to think in a new way. And I think that the reason that he's written this book in the first place right now is because there's been enough societal evolution that we're already beginning to think in that new way. So what I wanted to do today, to be in the seat of really introducing this book, particularly the introduction, the way I see myself using my time is this, if this is agreeable with everybody, to take our first session here and put what I see going on in this chapter, in these beginning chapters, in a kind of overview, and talk about some of the things that maybe Omurtu doesn't talk about himself, but which for me really context what he's doing. And then in the second half, after we've had our break, what I'd like to do is go through about three or four of what I think are the most challenging things he's saying in here, and just give you some time to respond to them and look at them and things like that. Would that be an okay? Mm-hmm. Is that what we're doing? Okay. Well, I want to begin by quoting a wonderful saying from the Gospel of Thomas, another of those wonderful little pieces from the Nag Hammadi Codex that we've gotten back into our tradition now. And in the very second saying, it goes like this. It says, seek, and you shall find. Okay, so far so good, right? But then it goes on, and he says, and when you find, you will become confused. Your confusion will give way to wonder. And in your wonder, you shall reign over all things. Want to hear that again?
Yeah.
Seek, and you shall find. But when you find, you will become confused. your confusion will give way to wonder. And in wonder, you will reign over all things. Now, if the Gospel of Thomas is as it claims to be, and as scholars more and more say, yeah, it probably is, an authentic record of the teachings of Jesus, then Jesus was telling us this process way back in the first century A.D. and sketching out the whole process that you probably already know in your seeking. Okay? Seek and you shall find. This is guaranteed in all Gospels. But the fine print that we usually don't say is that you aren't going to like what you find. Because all finding is intended to blow the box of your mind wide open so you can get a bigger box for a little while. So when you find, your initial response, if you're on the right path, if you're really seeking, will be confusion. It won't be, I found it. It'll be, huh? And this profound sense of unrest. And remember how Omurchu is telling you about that in his own preface? When he talks about how when his box of the tidy little Catholic orthodoxy priesthood that he grew up in began to give way. His first experiences were of absolutely intolerable turmoil, weren't they? He told the story about how he's talking with these British soldiers on a train one day, and the next day one of them's dead, killed by one of his fellow countrymen. Then he talks about going absolutely blah out of my backyard when someone asks him to come celebrate the Eucharist. And then that sets up such a ferment in him that he stumbles up to receive, and then that leads confusion. This is classic. It's the sign of a box breaking open. Okay? And so then the next point in this teaching is that confusion gives way to wonder. And wonder is a very interesting emotion because it's scary in a way. It's like, what the hell is going on? And yet in that moment of being between paradoxes, it's almost like being a little baby again. You know, and I'm watching my new grandson, Ethan, in that place. He's 5 days old now. And it's all wonder. He's looking around and it's like, okay, what are these? These are shapes. Why is mummy out there instead of, you know, right here? What's the noise? What's the, you know, and he has absolutely no context yet to put it in. So it's all raw, but it's so incredibly fresh and alive. So wonder is a good place because what it does is it vastly enhances your scale of the universe. Oh, I thought I knew what was going on, but I don't. It's bigger than my mind. And what we find in this book is, in a huge way, Dermot O'Murchu just gave way to wonder. All of a sudden, his universe is huge. It's so huge that it takes the whole of everything that ever was since the Big Bang. It's no longer a little box. You know, there's some parts of Christianity that still believe that the world began on Thursday, October 2nd, something like minus 2002. Mm-hmm. You know? But this is wonder. Eons, galaxies, hugeness. So, and then the saying goes and says, and in wonder you shall reign over all things. Because what it says is that the sense of wonder is a better way of relating to your universe than a sense of artificial control. You know, Rilke said the same thing in that wonderful quote about don't seek the answers that you can't yet understand, but rather live the questions. And what this book is about is a huge opportunity to live the questions. So, the proposition that he's putting in your face in this book is an incredibly destabilizing and vast one. His first idea is that our Western Judeo-Christian story has grown too small to be sustainable on the planet. Okay? Did you all get that from what he was saying? The story is just too small. It's too tied to a people. It starts too late in the history of the planet. It sees things too exclusively through a filter. It's not a big enough story. It doesn't really do honor to the length and depth and breadth of the universe. So that's his first thing. And literally, this is true. The story which we, in our Christian tradition, have called salvation history is a story which is only a little more than 3,000 years old. Though when you take where Genesis began up to now, it's a tiny sliver of a planet. Because you know that the story, the first people that enter the narrative, not counting the kind of legendary stuff before, the first historical figures we can actually find are Abraham. And then the first big story that we can actually date in time, Moses. That's only like 1500 BC, you know, a raindrop. So it's a tiny sliver. And he says that to call it salvation history just doesn't give enough, you know, big enough scale. The question is, what was God doing for all those eons before there was this people called Israel? Did God really only come into existence with a Judeo-Christian past? And Omertu says, I don't think so. So the second thing he says is that this particular story that we have, that we call salvation history, is based in domination, exclusivity, and exile. In other words, it's a story about the best team. You know, the one that has God on the side wins. And that this is not a story, this is not a set of attitudes that are sustainable within our planetary, within our fragile planet today. He says the story causes too much trouble, basically. That it's tied to an institution or a way of looking at things, a social organization, which he calls patriarchy, which rose up in the history of humankind and began to take form as a way of looking at the world about 5,000 BC. And so it's a story tied, it's a story of the world seen through the filter of patriarchy. And what he's implying today is that what we call God and are so pleased and honored and obsessive about getting exactly right and making statements about what God is and God isn't and how there's one God and three and, you know, all the stuff that we do in theology, that God, that concept, and the ability to have that concept is in and of itself rooted in that filter called patriarchy. And what he's saying here is that the problem is systemic. In other words, it doesn't go far enough just to think nice things about God, to make the Holy Spirit female. You know, it doesn't go far enough to try and love all people. What he's saying is that the filter itself is fatally flawed. In other words, as long as we use this filter, as long as we try to tell the story of who we are, who God is, and how we live in the planet, using this filter and the concepts that come through patriarchy, we're going to be working too small, and we're going to continue to perpetuate a circle, a cycle of exile, domination, and violence. In other words, You know, it's very interesting that the three great Abrahamic faiths, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, have probably caused about, I would say, somewhere around 75% of the damage and violence in recent history. And it's all because their concepts of who God is and who are they are founded in radical exclusivity. You know, my being right as a Christian requires the Jews and the Islamic people to be wrong. My religion is better. Jesus is the way, the truth, the life. No man comes to the Father except through him. We all know this. So these others are inferior paths. Well, or you take the Jewish people, you know, God gave us this land. God is the, Israel is the pen with which God writes. God gave us the Holy Land and we ain't leaving. Okay? Boom. What happened? War. So the problem is really deeply systemic. And the reason we can't seem to fix the hotbed of the Near East, you know, the Middle East, why we can't solve the Israeli-Palestinian crisis no matter what we do, doesn't lie in politics. It lies in this patriarchal filter in what he will say and what he develops in the second chapter of the book is people whose story depends on being more right than anybody else and whose sense of entitlement is wedded to a place. And what he says is that these are luxuries that the planet can no longer sustain. Okay? Now that's heavy. Talk about free fall. You know, it's like, you mean that everything I believe, I mean, what happens to credo and unum deum, from, you know, what happens to the cult, what happens to Jesus, what happens to, you know, what happens to it? It sounds like a massive blanket indictment of everything. Like the thing that you ought to do if you're a good Christian is to go out and commit Harry Carey or something. So this is huge. And then what he's adding, as if this wasn't revolutionary enough, is that he says, and meanwhile, while the ones of us that still call ourselves Christians or Jews or Islamic people, the ones of us that are still into religion, are still dealing with outmoded and dangerous concepts, that most of the world is massively indifferent to this anyway. That more and more of the stories that we keep telling ourselves, and we tell ourselves with more and more intensity and indifference, is a massive ho-hum for the rest of the people in the world. You know, have you met all of you sitting here know at least two or three friends who have said, I'm spiritual, not religious. Yeah, we all know that. That's become a kind of modern Bible now. And what it means, I've had billions of folks who've said that to me, it means that I still believe in something that's holy, mystical, inspired, sacred about the human soul. But I don't believe that religion, as it's been practiced, certainly in anything I've known as I've grown up as a Christian, people say, but what's all? Something of mine.
Yeah, something of mine. No, that's
mine here. Oh, okay.
A little mic.
Oh.
It'll be okay.
Okay, great. Sorry.
I'm going to try to tape it right.
Okay, there we go. Technology pause. Thank you.
Sure.
So what they're saying, basically, is that there's a rising world consciousness that says religion, as it's been practiced, at least as it's been practiced in the West, is a luxury that the world cannot afford anymore. In other words, that the cultural level of the world, the ethical level of the world, the sense of what it takes to be a citizen of the planet Earth has moved beyond anything that's exemplified or acted out or modeled in religion. In other words, as he says in this incredibly in-your-face quote, which we'll come back and talk about after the break, he says, religion is disintegrating because it has served its purpose. So he says the problem isn't just that there's a history of corruption, there's a history of, you know, it's not things that can be easily fixed, but somehow what we've known as religion, and I'm just talking about religion at this point, I'm not talking about Catholic religion or Episcopalian religion or Jewish religion, I'm talking about religion itself has served its purpose. So this is a huge thesis. And I just say sort of interestingly, because we're always dovetailing with this, I think that the kind of mud pie that the Pope stepped into last week is a classic example of this. Aside from the fact that he vastly overestimated the intelligence level of the press to know that he was quoting somebody and not saying it directly. But you see, what he was doing is he was still working from within a Catholic Western context. And the rest of the world said, hello, get a life, you can't say these things, even if you think you're contexting them. Because the rest of the world has gone to a place where statements that incite violence and incite superiority are themselves part of the problem. We're growing. I think there is something emerging which you might call a global ethic beyond the edges of religion, carried mostly in interspirituality today. But there is a sense of basic human spaciousness, tolerance, and letting be that people on the planet have sort of come to because they realize that the alternatives are too hard. Horrid, I said, not hard. Okay? So this is where this book is situated. And what I want to do is to set a stage in which we can rise to the challenge of what he's throwing us here, which I think is 95% correct, without feeling like we therefore have to abandon our faith, quote, quote, faith, no longer practice it, that you can't be a Christian anymore, he's pulled the rug out from under you. But I think that if you work with what he's saying, there's a way that we can build back our Christian walk, our Christian path, and the core of our Christian understanding, which is our relationship with our entirely contemporary risen Master Jesus in a brand new way that gives life. And we can still say things like the creeds, and we can still celebrate the Eucharist and even sing Gregorian chant, coming from a new and expanded place. So that's what I want to hold out to you as a possibility as we work with it. But we can't get to that possibility when we're saying no. We can only get to that possibility once we've said yes to the essence of what he said, and then go into the integrative work. That's my theory. Okay. So you guys are real pioneers. I can't think of any other basically Catholic audience in North America that would have the courage to step up to the plate on this one. So how you work with this is going to be crucially important. And I'd like to say, and maybe this is obstreperous of me being an Episcopalian and, according to some of the curia, part of the problem, but I would like to dedicate the highest level of the work that you are able to produce in this class over the next... How long are you going to do it, Alice?
November 3rd.
Okay. Over the next couple of months, then, let's dedicate it to Pope Benedict. I'm not being facetious here. I'm not being a bit facetious. I believe that this man is growing. His ability to admit, take personal responsibility for what he did is huge. I think that more and more the church needs places like this that are avenues of inquiry to begin to raise something and integrate something. So it's on that basis that I'm not being at all facetious. And I think that the Donut is probably in a different place than me. I get a real strong, let's kick over the traces from him, and you guys ought to have fun when he actually gets here. I'm in an integration place. And part of that comes from my work with centering prayer. But what I want to do now is to give you a slightly different paradigm in which to frame what he's saying. What he's saying is absolutely accurate in terms of the timeline, the things like that. But I don't think he goes far enough in really looking at what the cause of this is. He makes this big boogeyman out of something called patriarchy. Like, all of a sudden, 5,000 years ago, there was this plot. A group of people got together and invented, and they were men.
Yeah.
And they invented, and they invented this big bad thing called patriarchy, and they used it to beat up on all these quiet, peaceable, women-driven women that were into matriarchy. It sounds like the Cal UCS games. I don't believe there was this big, bad institution called patriarchy. It pushes it it's too small. It demonizes. I think what actually happens is much more interesting and very, very well documented. That what we find is that about 5,000 years ago, roughly contemporaneous with what he calls patriarchy, and probably causing it, became a shift in the way the mind worked, a shift in the brain. It's a huge leap forward in human evolutionary consciousness. But what began to happen is that we developed a brain that was capable of self-reflexive thinking. In other words, the capacity to stand outside yourself and think about yourself in third person. You know, people will say a frog on a lily pad probably doesn't say, am I happy in my frogness? Am I fulfilling my frogness? Could I be a better frog? Where is Froggy God? The frog mind doesn't think that way. But there was a human evolutionary leap that began to allow the mind to think in terms of before and after, inside and outside. The mind began to think in terms of seeing in black and white, dim and that. A thing in the brain called the binary operator began to take shape, which can think in terms of either or. So these are huge evolutionary leaps forward. Now, many people say in a period about 800 BC to 200 BC, all around the world, there was a further evolutionary leap that happened just sort of bing, 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 bing all over the planet. That in our particular corner of the frog pool, it was the era of the great prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah. But other things were happening around the world. It was in Persia. It was the land of time of Zoroastrianism. In India, you got the Buddha and the teachings of Lao Tse. In Greece, you got Pythagoras and the whole. In other words, there is yet another leap forward in terms of human evolutionary consciousness. And The first person who noticed this was a philosopher named Carl Jaspers. Some of you know Carl Jaspers. And he was so impressed by this that he gave it the name the axial period. Axial, A-X-I-A-L, because he says it's the axis on which everything else turned. And it is from this period what happened across the world in all these different places, and you can see it real clearly in the Old Testament. What begins to rise up is a sense of personal salvation and personal destiny. Personal responsibility to a God. So, remember in Jeremiah said in one of his passages, it used to be said, the fathers have sinned and the children's teeth are set on edge. But now, basically, every person stands by and is accountable to his own destiny. Ethics becomes an individual matter, an individual guilt, an individual responsibility. So, what we have then is a two-tier step ahead going on at this time. In the early times, back about 5,000 years ago, we get the ability of the brain to think in terms of either or, to begin to think in terms of future, destiny, to begin to make sense of things by separating. Okay? And that coincides with the beginning of patriarchy. And I think is the real root of what finally gave rise, once the brain did that, patriarchy was virtually inevitable. It wasn't because the men went into a locker room somewhere and decided to have a new political revolution. Once the brain started seeing this way, that's what happened. Okay? And then we have this other worldwide mysterious leap that really gave us the birth of full-fledged egoic consciousness in the axial period. Now, it's very interesting that most of the great world religions took definitive shape in this period. Certainly in the beginning of patriarchy, but even more intently during the axial period. So that all the great families of world religions have their roots in this particular way of looking at the brain. You know, this particular structure of the brain. Okay? And so what happened about 2,000 years ago in our little corner of the frog pond, once again, somebody came into the planet falling like a meteor out of outer space. A fellow by the name of Jesus. And Jesus thought in a completely different way. He just didn't see. It was like his brain didn't work the same way that brains were used to working in the culture of his time. Now, if you've been well-trained Catholics, you'll say, well, of course not, because he was the Son of God. But I think something else is at stake here. Because now, as we're beginning 2,000 years later to still struggle with and wrestle with his teaching, what we see is that he's modeling and looking out of a shift in the brain which was about 2,000 years ahead of its time, but which now more and more the planet is catching up with. And you might call it, in a way, unitive consciousness or non-dual consciousness. You worked with the Beatitudes last semester, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? See how the consciousness comes from a different place? And what is characteristic of the consciousness that Jesus is coming out of is that it doesn't have that binary operator in it. Okay? It doesn't split the world into subject-object, goodies and baddies, right and wrong, them and us. And so it doesn't see about it. I like to use the image, the analogy of computer. You know, I think one of the neat things about the computer era is it gives us this wonderful set of new metaphors. And basically, what happened in Jesus humanity had been working with a certain operating system, and Jesus came and modeled an upgrade. And it's an upgrade that we can now download if we're ready. Basically, the egoic operating system, which is the operating system we've been working out of for the past, at least since the axial period, it's pretty good for working in this world. We've had universities, it gave us all of scholastic theology, it gave us our councils, it gave us our creeds, but it runs a program that's basically binary, either or, black, white, yes, no. It can't cope with paradox. It has to have it one way or the other. That's what this operating system does. And it's based on the way it works, the whole way you see things when you're seeing the world using your egoic operating system, is it divides it into bits and names the parts. And so when you look at you and try to say what you are using this, you'll start naming all the things that make you unique, right? All the things that make you different from everybody else, because that's what we mean by unique, right? My 3-year-old granddaughter is already learning to use her egoic operating system via Sesame Street. And she sits there and watches them going, one of these things is not like the other. And you're supposed to tell how a dog is not like a cat? That's egoic operating 101. Okay? But we all do this. This is how we're trained to think, aren't we? This is how the brain works. So when you say, who am I, according to using your egoic operating system, it's a matter of getting the right definition of yourself. Oh, I thought I was an Enneagram 6, but I'm really an 8. we do this all the time. We want to find the right picture. That's a fundamental shortcoming of the egoic operating system. Now, what Jesus knew was there was a way of seeing and a way of being in the world that didn't do that. It didn't have that bifocal lens right across the middle that had to split things into inside and outside, me and them, subject and predicate, but could hear, sort of like you hear a chord. Remember when we did Be Still and Know That I Am God, and some of you put in the fifth of the chord and the third to make it beautiful harmony? That is sort of a model of this other way of seeing. Non-dual, we call it now. It can perceive without making distinctions. It sees no separation between God and neighbor, between inside and outside, between self and other. Love your neighbor as yourself. Not as much as yourself. That's what the egoic operating system says, comparison, contrast, but as yourself. A little bit harder. Jesus saw that directly. And he used to teach in parables that were very much like Zen koans. In other words, they really destabilized not the political structure, but the mental conceptual structure. And for me, the most powerful of Jesus' Cohen parables is Matthew 20, the laborers in the vineyard. You know, because it operates exactly like a Zen Cohen, like the sound of one hand clapping. As long as you are in egoic operating system, you cannot make sense of this parable. Because you'll always say, it's not fair, right? Right. Because the egoic operating system perceives from scarcity. And the reason it perceives from scarcity is because its basic operational mechanism is separation. So it's always having to cut up the pie so it can see what a slice is. That's why it's always anxious. That's why it's always violent. Systemically. Okay? So Jesus kept seeing a different world. He saw through filters that didn't have to do that and that perceived abundance. And you notice that the signature of Jesus in all his stories, in all his teachings, in all his parables is abundance. Loaves and fishes out the wazoo. Wine more than you can drink at the wedding. Pressed down, running over. The prodigal son story, he doesn't just say, "Oh yeah, there's a sandwich in the refrigerator, make yourself at home." It's total abundance. Because for Jesus, this is the arch metaphor of seeing without separation. Okay, now, to make a long story short, what I see happening, and what I see happening, particularly on the strength of some of these new Gospels we're getting back, like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, Jesus was a unitive seer. The first that we'd ever seen in the Western world. He was so far ahead of his time that very, very few people could catch up with him. And the ones that did tended to get run out, like Mary Magdalene. And instead, the church, still using the egoic filter, tried to make sense out of Jesus' teachings. And what happened was sort of like, y'all remember in grade school when they took the globe and tried to hang it up as a map on the wall? What they call the Mercator projection? What happens to Greenland? It gets distorted, doesn't it? That's what happened to Jesus' unit of teaching when people tried to run it through the egoic operating system. Huge distortions. How you try to do a gospel of radical inclusivity, radical nonviolence, with a mind that's only thinking in either or, you're going to get into some mistakes. And a thing that says, "the first shall be last," which Jesus hears as meaning, don't make categories. You know, where are first and last directly next to each other? On a circle, right? But what we do when we put it in Mercator projection, you hear a strategy. Oh, if I want to be first later, I should be last now. I should be humble, and then I'll get my rewards in heaven, which is later. Egoic operating system, okay? So what we have done, and this is what gives me hope, is that over the years, over the eons, while Christianity has been catching up with the operating system that Jesus actually used, there's been a lot of distortion introduced into Christianity. Christianity is the Greenland of Jesus' teachings. Okay? Now, this is actually good news, because people are now saying more and more that humanity as a whole is beginning to emerge towards what some are calling a second axial. If any of you have read Ewart Cousin's wonderful book, Christ in the 21st Century, this is exactly his point, that human beings are beginning to catch up to a way that they can learn to find that other operating system which is actually in you. And people have talked about it in the tradition for years and years and years, but we haven't really understood what it means. It's called the heart operating system, the way of the heart. And we're used to talking about the heart in terms of emotions. Oh, I feel that this is authentic. That's not what the heart is. We've all heard about the GPS now in navigation, right? The global positioning system. Your heart is also your GPS, your God positioning system. And it works, and all the ancient traditions and the actual Christian inner traditions will tell you this. It works by spontaneously and simultaneously reverberating in sympathetic vibration with the divine willingness for your being. So you unfold in resonance with your own true destiny and with the planet. So it's a vibrational, it's a resonating system that we all have. And once you learn to steer by it, you can hear, you can respond, you can relate, you can include without causing violence. It's a non-violent system. Now, we all have it in us. For me, the greatest thing that happened to Christianity in the past 30, 40 years that has prepared the way for what we're seeing and what we're looking at right now on our plates here is the recovery within Christianity of meditation. It was an absolutely necessary prerequisite before any of this could happen. And a lot of people think that meditation is about piety and that contemplation is about a virtuous lifestyle where people are silent. Not primarily. The real value of meditation is that it's kind of like a toggle switch that begins to switch you from the egoic operating system to this other. And as you work with it, and as you allow meditation to take you to that place which you think is silent or you think is empty, it's actually neither silent nor empty. What it is it's the beginning of like seeing in the dark, where, you know, when you first turn off the light, it just seems like totally black. But after a while, if you sit there and don't grab for your flashlight, you begin to realize you can see in the dark, that there are faculties implanted within you that allow you to understand, relate, hear, perceive, catch the pattern. And they are in each one of us. Jesus, I believe, was the first modeler in Christianity of unit of consciousness. Our heart is set up to lead us along that path. Meditation helps us to move along that path. So, because it backs you out of, it turns off that egoic mind that immediately learns to react, compare, and measure. And if you hear this book with your egoic mind, you're going to have missed the opportunity. And you're going to make him into either a savior or a demon. But if you can begin to hear and work with these concepts from a deeper place, my sense is that we are midwives to something wonderful. And that what he's saying is wonderful. We have the opportunity now to say, first and foremost, not that I'm a Catholic or a Christian or a Westerner, but that I am an earthling. I am a member of a wonderful, wonderful universe that was given to us by God, a rich, creative, beautiful, sheltering, merciful universe, to participate in the growth, in the increase of love. And this book will allow us to connect back again, if we do it right, with some of the message that Jesus said, which I think was just this, and to begin to live it in unity with our Islamic, with our Buddhist, with our native brethren and sisters, in a whole new way of being. So I think we can find that in this book. But what I'm really going to challenge you to do is, as you start to read this book and work with it, if you could take 5 minutes before you begin just to do that little practice that we did before, that for 5 minutes, and you can put on the timer if you like, whenever any kind of thought comes up in your mind, just let it go. So you're practicing this. That's actually the method of centering prayer in a nutshell. But do that. And then when you come into the group, as you begin to deal with the challenging statements he makes, do that first. So that you don't immediately go to I agree or I disagree and try and create your battlements around it. But that you listen to what may be coming through this very challenging message, I think is a capacity for a healing and a rebirth that's beyond our wildest imaginations. Okay, so it's 11. I'm going to stop right now, and we get 10 minutes to go and raid the cookie jar. And then we'll come back, and I'm just going to throw a few quotes in your face and hear what you have to say about it. Okay? Thank you.